You know the phrase, missing the forest for the trees. Or, phrased another way, getting lost in the forest while you're looking at the trees and wander from the paths. I never enjoyed math much. And I shouldn't use past tense there. I still don't enjoy math much. And I think the fact that I don't enjoy math much goes back to that idea, missing the forest for the trees. Me and other classmates growing up, it seemed about every year, we would try this question upon a new teacher to see if we might get a better answer. And the question we would ask year after year, what is the point of math? Why the suffering? Why are we doing this? They would reply, I think there's a good answer for this, by the way, but they would reply, passing tests, and maybe you'll become an engineer someday. Those were the best answers that could be given. Of course, when you're in elementary school, it's not very satisfying. It's like, well, what's it relate to video games, you know? It's just not useful to me. So they weren't very satisfying to people. Well, not knowing the big picture really hurt my enjoyment and understanding of math. To me, math was a bunch of unrelated disciplines. Like, what's geometry have to do with algebra? What's algebra? I didn't ever get to trigonometry. I didn't get past algebra. It was just an unrelated branch of complicated exercises, and the books were written into me what was a foreign language of terms and equations and et cetera, et cetera. Well, have you ever heard the joke, don't pray for patience? I don't like that joke. I think I've mentioned before, because I think we ought to pray for patience, because patience is such a wonderful fruit in life, and it's a strong Christian characteristic, and it will get you through much. But there is a reason for that joke, and I did pray for patience, and the Lord gave me college algebra. He gave me more math. I should have known that would be the result. And so my freshman year in college, I remember taking a math class, and I think it says something about my bad attitude toward math that in my memory, the class was occurring at 3 a.m. It must have been more like 8 a.m. at the very earliest, but it felt like 3 a.m. to me. And I didn't understand it. But by the end of it, I worked so hard, I got a C in college algebra, and I got a lot of patience. And now, you know, again, apologies to any math teachers and teachers out there, but now, you know, when I'm facing hardship, I say, I can do this because I did college algebra. Patience is good. Anyway, I think the larger part of my struggle in understanding math goes back to not saying the big picture. Because actually this week I started taking Hebrew, and it's every bit as painful, and in fact is an actual foreign language with all kinds of exceptions to rules. It's even worse than English in its complexity, to me at least. And I'm doing okay, and I'm enjoying it. Because I see the purpose, I see the point, I know what I'm going to do with it, I know what it's for. So my struggle with math, what's it for, how's it fit, where are all these numbers going? Not knowing the big picture made it frustrating and harder to understand. If I knew it, I think I would do a little better. Well, I think that for a lot of Christians, unfortunately, the Bible can be like that sometimes. At times, the Bible can appear like a collection of unconnected stories, some of which we fail to see how they relate to the whole at all. Many probably reading the story of the life of Abraham and this business about he is tested in his faith and asked to sacrifice his son, this business of animals being divided in front of him, and then a lantern passing between the animals in this covenant. You read that and you're, what is going on here, and what does this have to do with the rest of the Bible? You might read even about something like Exodus and see the plagues that are going on there and struggle to see how that might relate to the big story of the Bible. Interesting point on that, though. I learned somewhat recently, if you look at the very end of Revelation, where the bowls of wrath are being poured out, there are so many parallels between that and the plagues that were poured out on Egypt. All kinds of parallels. There's even a group of people who march across a river and the waters are separated for them. But this time it's being separated so the enemies of God can come to be destroyed and fighting against him, rather than the friends of God being saved from his enemies. So Exodus, the plagues, actually do have a relation to the story, but it can be easy to miss that sometimes. Not being able to see a connection, there have been Christians who have looked at the book of Ecclesiastes, and they've said it not to be in the Bible, because they don't see how it fits in with the rest of the Bible. I believe Martin Luther had that opinion toward Ecclesiastes, actually. It's just too cynical and shouldn't be in there. And there's Christians who've looked at the Song of Solomon and not known what to do with it. A lot of Christians interpret it as a spiritual allegory between Jesus and the church, because they just don't know what to do with this book that is dripping with romance and even some innuendo in there. They say, surely that doesn't belong. It must be some kind of allegory, because they fail to see maybe the big picture of God's intention for marriage. But anyway, there's a lot of good we can learn from both Song of Solomon, both Ecclesiastes. All of the books of the Bible are connected and belong. I think part of the reason, though, that many of us can struggle in this way is because there's so many Christians who have never read through the Bible in its entirety. And even if you have, it's very unlikely you did so quickly because it's a big book. I have read through the Bible a couple times, never faster than a year, though. And if you take a book like this and read it over the course of a year, it can be very easy to kind of stop seeing the big picture of what this book has to do with that book and where the story is and what's going on. Another related reason is preaching. When I preach, when other preachers preach, we are focused on at most a chapter. When I do a whole chapter of the Bible, it feels like I'm doing too much, even for just a chapter. Sometimes I'll only do one time. A couple times I've only done one verse. Recently I did three verses. I don't think I'll ever finish the whole Bible in my preaching here. There's just too much to do. And of course it's good to in our devotions, in our reading, in our preaching, to focus in. God utilizes that to target focused areas of our life. You know, we have needs where we're really weak. And as we read through the Word and encounter that rebuke or reproof from God's Word in that area, we stop, we meditate, we think, we grow on those things. But the downside to that slow approach is that so few Christians know how it all fits together. They don't know what Exodus has to do with Revelation. They don't know that Abraham and David and Jesus have a connection with promises given to Abraham, then to David, being fulfilled in Jesus. They don't know that Leviticus and Hebrews are deeply related. Genesis, the book of Romans, is dripping with the book of Genesis all over it. They don't know what the purpose of the Mosaic Law was given for, what it should mean today, if anything, for Christians. So I've had in my mind for a while, and I believe now is the right time to begin this series as we are emphasizing Bible study, I've had this idea that I want to tell the story of the Bible in ideally as few sermons as possible. It's not going to be a through the Bible verse by verse kind of series. That would take the rest of my life, and I probably still wouldn't finish it. Instead, is going to be kind of a big picture, biblical overview, helping us to see how some things connect. And the first that we're doing is just to tell the big story of the Bible, and then from there I'm going to just, in coming weeks, trace some themes and ideas and other things that will show themselves through the Bible, like Abraham. Abraham, God introduces a promise to that man that you can trace from his descendant to his descendant's descendant, even being reaffirmed over to Jesus. And the promise has a lot to do with the end times and the millennial kingdom. We'll do some things like that to begin to see how all of this book gels. And it will help us to understand it better in our Bible study, see how different things piece together. Obviously, it's a very big book, and if I tried to overview all the possible questions you might have about what this relates, we'd end up missing the big picture again. So it won't answer everything, but it'll give you prayerfully ideas and tools to see how God's Word all sticks together, and he's telling a beautiful story and working out a wonderful plan in everything that he is doing on this earth. So what is that story? What is the story of the Bible? What's the story of human history? What is and has God been doing in all of this time, and what is the point of it all? Well, the quickest way to understand the big picture of any book is to know the beginning and the end. Now, if you're reading a good novel, I wouldn't recommend turning to the end and finding out what happens at the end. But if you want to know what the story is about and what the problem is, how it's solved, who the hero of the story is, etc., then the best way to do that is to open it up, read the first few pages, then turn to the end and read the last few pages, and you will find who the hero is, you will find what the problem is, you will find what the solution ultimately to the problem is, and where this story is driving, the conclusion that the protagonist is working toward in the story. So the structure of most stories, and this is a historical story, it's a true story, but the structure of most stories, be they fiction or nonfiction, is this. The protagonist or hero, the main character of the story, he is introduced at the beginning. You get your opening scene, and usually it's an idyllic, nice setting. There's not a lot of problems going on. You have your hero, your protagonist, he is introduced. Not long into the story, some conflict or issue arises. By the end of the story, the conflict or issue that was introduced has been overcome. What occurs in the middle of that story is the protagonist's heroic effort.